feedback and to make the most of that new game. So look, I'll hand that over to Matt, and please welcome him.
Hello, thank you, Mark. All right, hey, so the purpose here is to learn how to harness that good stuff from your users to make your game better. And there's two main sources that I want to focus on, many ways to use user feedback, but I think we can get through a whole hour just talking about usability testing and beta testing, both ways to harness what your users have to say about your game to make it more fun, more playable, and get it tuned properly. So we'll do those two, and we'll have some time for Q&A at the end. If you have something you really want to ask right away, you can interrupt me, but otherwise we'll do Q&A at the end. I won't read all this about me, because Mark already did all that, so this is about me. I've been doing games for 14 years as a game designer or producer or both, linked together. And I've gone through the arcade phase, which really tuned me a lot into usability. When you have an arcade game, you put it out literally in the arcade, and you're not allowed to say anything. You have to sit back and just see whether people walk by and look at your game, whether they drop a quarter in your game, and whether they spend another quarter. So it's very intense, very clear feedback on whether your game is any fun or not. And Atari, of course, by the time I went, they were past the, you know, heyday, but they're still making some really good games. San Francisco Rush, for example, was a game that was made while I was there by a friend of mine. So they still have that really good culture of how do you make a game fun and usable, and how do you make it hot? How do you get it to grab somebody's attention right away and keep them there? So arcade was a really good proving ground for that. And Microsoft Game Studios also, because Microsoft is very orderly, they had a very scientific usability system, which actually has been noted in many circles as a very good usability system. You wouldn't always know it by using Microsoft software, but their game studios, like Halo, for example, heavily used a usability system, and the game really improved a great deal. So I have a lot of respect for their methodology. So that's me. Okay. First, I'll talk about one source of feedback which doesn't really count as user testing, which is team testing. The team that's making the game or the people who are working at the company playing the game. And it's a great thing. So obviously you should do that. I've seen a lot of great good come out of it. You know how team testing works. You make it playable as soon as possible. Every week it's great to get together on a Friday afternoon and everybody, you know, plays their own game. I think it's really important. It's very good for a bunch of things. It's great for the team bonding. It's great to make sure the game is stable. It's great to build up a set of players who know the game really well. Because these other things I'm going to talk about, usability and beta, you're not necessarily going to get really hardcore players very fast. Those take, of course, weeks of playing your game to get to be a good, hardcore, strong player. So team playing is great for that, for the people who really know the game well, so you can make sure it's difficult enough at the end. But it's not great for evaluating fun or usability, and I will tell you why. All right, so one thing is that, as you probably know, it's impossible to be really objective when you've got a team or a company playing its own game. As good as it is for the other reasons, you don't get objectivity and you need more than this. One is that nobody there really represents the target player. You know, we can't fool ourselves into thinking that we are representative of our audience, even though maybe we used to represent our audience. Just by working in a game company, you become too IT savvy. You know too much about how to use a computer. You know all these conventions from talking about games and playing a bunch of games that you can't unlearn in your head. And also, you're too experienced with playing pre-release games. There's a certain art to getting squeezing the fun out of a game that's not released yet. And so you kind of subconsciously build up, you know, all these methods to have fun with a game that's just not ready yet. Those who are making the game, as you can expect, are really too close to it to really know whether it's fun or usable. You can't forget how it works. You know, so if you can't unlearn all the things that you'll see naive users stumble across. And also, unless you've got a really good team that's very honest with each other, it's always safer, politically or just with friends of yours, to talk about what works well. If you see something that doesn't work well, it's hard as a team member sometimes to speak up. Whereas the usability testing will bring that stuff out. Those who are managing the game makers, you know, others who are at the company being the managers, well, they're really too invested in one sense. It's hard to really get into the fun of the game when you're thinking, oh, I'm spending so much money on this game. It's hard to clear that out of your head. And also, there's a natural conservative motive, because if they're working with marketing or they're looking at the publisher's bottom line, they're going to be tempted to think of it in terms of, well, what worked already? So it's going to be a more conservative mindset. And it's sort of the opposite. It's safer for them to say, oh, this is what I don't like about your game, X, Y, and Z, because then nothing can come back and bite them in the ass later if they said something's really great and it turns out to be really badly reviewed. You know, that's sort of a dangerous place for them to be in sometimes. So they're sort of on the opposite. It's safer for them to criticize your game than commend it. So what you need is... Oh, sorry. Just one last thing before I get into the usability. Also, there's a bit of a distinction I've found between what's fun to make and what is fun to play. And it's easy to get confused sometimes. There are some systems that are really fun to make, particularly as a designer. They're fun to talk about, you get to argue about the specs a lot, they're very clever, and you can really have a lot of meaty problems. But they're not necessarily fun to play, and it's easy to confuse those two. All right, so one of the two big methods that I want to talk about is usability testing. So I'll go into a few slides on that. All right, so usability testing. The goal of usability testing is to figure out what is not intuitive and not easy to use in your game. It's a pretty scientific method. A lot of the people who laid out usability methods or to do usability testing, they have a psych degree. So they're used to a very scientific, controlled testing environment. And even though that doesn't seem intuitive because games are so organic and so subjective, you can still objectify it and it's useful. So I'll talk about how that's done. So it's a scientific method that looks for that objectivity. You do want subjects that represent your audience. So usually you have a questionnaire. You gather up these usability people by mailing lists or putting flyers in game stores or spreading the word amongst friends and family. You want to make sure that they represent your audience. If you're doing a usability test on a first-person shooter, you want to get people who at least have played first-person shooters. You don't really want to make sure that somebody's grandma who's never used a computer can find it usable, because you'll find a lot of false positives. You do want people who are at least enthusiastic about first-person shooters. And you want to learn everything about them. So when you have that result of how they did, you want to say, huh, people who played a lot of Halo got this one control aspect. People who played a lot of Quake, they totally missed it. You might find trends there. So they know your game genre, and they're interested in your game, but they're totally naive to your game. They cannot have ever seen or played your game before. At Maxis, they call these guys tissue testers. You know, like you use it once and you throw it away. You shouldn't throw away tissue after you use it. You use them once and you throw them away. And you have to go through them. And Maxis, among other companies, will go through hundreds of these people in the course of testing one game. Usability testing is usually done over and over and over again. It starts off very early. It might have five or six flights of tests all the way through the development. It's done in a rather carefully controlled, sterile environment. So like I said, you want objectivity, so you want every test to have very similar conditions so you can really compare the outcomes. Now, it would be great to be able to test this with hundreds of people, but that's a lot of data to go through. These are pretty time-consuming. You know, one usability test could take 2 or 3 hours of your time when it comes to setting them up, walking them in, having them do the test, and looking at their results. So you're lucky if you can get, you know, 12 to 20 people. From a scientific point of view, that's not statistically significant, and you have to accept that. When you crunch the numbers, you have to account for the fact that you might have come across just one random problem, and I talk about how to deal with that. So that's usability testing, and it's done very similarly in a lot of big companies. I'm based on what I know from Microsoft and from what I've heard of Maxis and EA and places like that. Actually, I don't know much about EA, so I'd love to hear if anybody's done usability testing at EA to compare. All right. So why do you do it? Well, when your game is intuitive and easy, it allows the fun to sort of take root. And sometimes it gets discounted. Sometimes you think, well, look, the game is fun once you figure it out. And people pay, you know, for the game, so surely they're going to stick with it for a little while. So what if it's a little bit hard to learn? Eventually they'll get the hang of it. We can blow past all that. And it would be nice to not solve usability problems, because they're pretty tough to solve. But even if people catch on to your game, you still want to make sure that it flows, because it's hard to enjoy yourself when you've got that little thing that's nagging you. Imagine you've all played games that are just hard to use. And also, that first impression is so important with a game. You know, I think you kind of fall in love with a game for the first 15 minutes that you play it. Like the first 15 minutes I played Zelda or Diablo or any of the games I ended up really loving, I knew within 5 minutes that this was going to be one of my favorite games. And a lot of that is because the usability issues didn't get in the way, and you're able to just have a completely emotional reaction to the game. So I think that's important, to make sure that first 10 minutes is just as sweet as possible. Also, if you do usability testing early, you can head off big problems because these problems don't tend to go away. You might find out only in beta that you've got a huge comprehension issue. It'd be very expensive to fix those problems later. Usability testing is very valuable earlier in the system. Also, one really good thing about usability testing is that it lets you get into the heads of your audience. You get to see what excites them, and that can really give you a lot of good ideas. And sometimes the random things they say, and they can say some really random stuff that you would never have thought of, it can really inspire some good ideas. And I don't think you have to pay them for it. You can take their ideas. You make them sign a waiver ahead of time. Anything they say, you get full possession of. So usability testing really is good to inspire what to do next. All right, so preparing for usability tests, you can read online, and I'm sure you can find a lot of details, but this is the short version. The game itself can be really limited in its functionality at this point. It could be just the first playable. And you might think it's silly, like, well, all that we can do is drive. There's no power-ups, there's no scoring, there's no timer, there's no crashing, there's no anything. All you do is drive. Why do usability test? That's actually a really good time to do usability test for the reasons I'll describe later, because that's what your player is going to spend 80% of their time doing. You might as well nail it earlier. So first playables is plenty to do a usability test on, and you're going to do several of them, hopefully, through development. Very early testing, believe it or not, you can do some really good stuff with just screenshots, where you have a series of screenshots in a Flash application or even just a JPEG viewer on the screen. We did this with Ashram's Call, where you put something up on the screen and say, okay, if you wanted to find out what was in your inventory, where do you think you would click on the screen? And all that it was just a 2D mock-up. Well, it's a lot better to figure out whether people know whether, the bag is the thing to do, or maybe it's the hand, or it's the gold bar, or what icon sort of leaps out at people. It's a lot better to do that as a mock-up before you implement it, especially with more complicated things. Like, well, let's say that you've leveled up and you want to spend your skill points. What do you think you would do next at this screen? And you can actually do a sequence of screenshots. You say, okay, now that you've clicked that, yes, very good. You move on to the next screenshot and say, okay, now what would you click? And again, without having to waste programming time, you can figure out what's intuitive. It could save you a lot of time. It is important that your game doesn't have a lot of big bugs, mostly because it can really randomize the results. If one person crashes and another person doesn't, then it's going to be harder to compare the results. So if that one person who crashed had some weird one-off usability problem, you'll never really know, well, is that because they got confused by the crash, or they're upset because of the crash, or whatever else. So you do want to make sure you have a small amount of stable stuff there. Another part of prep is you have a clear script of what the examiner is going to say. Literally, like read out like a movie script. Again, just keep it neutral and the same. So you don't need very much. Just asking people to do 10 things, like how do you think you'd operate your inventory? How do you think you'd spend skill points? Or if it's an action game, just jump around a lot. Try to get up on that ledge or try to climb this tree. Just 10 things can take up an hour easily. And people's attention starts to crash after an hour, so that's about how long you want these things to be. You also want to set up ahead of time a real grid for metrics, real tick boxes in an Excel sheet or something, so you can objectify, okay, we asked somebody to, climb the tree, and it took them this many seconds before they were at the top of the tree. It sounds really nitpicky, but you can pick out these big trends eventually by saying, look, consistently people are spending a lot longer figuring this out than we want, the amount of time to get it right. Or it's the number of tribes, like, find your inventory. Well, how many bad clicks did they make before they found what they were looking for? All right, so once you've prepared, how do you actually do the usability testing? A few things. One is you have a neutral examiner, meaning someone who can profess that they have nothing to do with the game, they don't work on the game, they don't know anybody on the game, they don't like anybody who's worked on the game, they are not going to tell anybody on the game what they was said, even though you have to warn them this is being recorded and the team may review it. You build a bond between the examiner and the subject so they can really relax and they can say exactly what's on their mind. And if subconsciously they think, oh, I'm going to hurt this guy's feelings because he's the designer, that can really get in the way of what they have to say. If you can't have a neutral examiner, make sure you point out ahead of time, like, look, I really want you to tell me what's wrong with the game, because if you don't tell me, 10,000 people are going to tell me once I ship the game, and I'd much rather hear it now rather than, that many people. So make sure you at least can appear neutral. You want to record carefully several things, and it's not just the screen, obviously. You want to record on a screen capture or a video camera. But you also want to get the player's voice. You want to get the player's face and hands for reasons that I'll describe. You want to see the emotions that the player is going through. One thing that Halo did, that I heard Halo did, that worked quite well, is as they're playing, they just had clickers. They might have been buttons on a keyboard or actual clickers that said, look, anytime you feel bored, just click this button. Or anytime you feel like, oh, I like that, or I was confused. And what they did is they actually put spots on the map when people clicked those things. And they would look at, after the aggregate of how many people, you know, look at all these dots for I am confused clustering right around this spot. Let's go into that level and figure out, like, what is confusing people? Why can't they tell which way to go? Let's put in a big landmark, or let's make a slope to the ground. You know, let's not reverse the slope on the ground, or whatever is confusing people. So clickers can give you those objective data points. When you're doing usability testing, the examiner should, again, go strictly through the script, like literally read it out. You can improvise a little bit if people get confused or if you want to dig deeper, but make sure you're testing people pretty much the same way. And one thing that you prompt people to do is not just do stuff, but have them battle whatever is on their mind. You know, that internal monologue, you know, that you have while you're playing a game, just encourage people to reveal it. If they go quiet, sometimes the examiner says, okay, what are you thinking right now? You know, what have you figured out so far? And just get them to sort of spit out whatever's on their mind. It's uncomfortable for them at first, so you got to give them time to warm up. But pretty soon, they just kind of unleash. So you've done usability testing. You got those 8, 12, 20 different things. Now what do you do with the results? And this is one reason why you don't want to have 100 people, because this takes some work. One thing, of course, you've got a recording. And you should really watch the player as much as the screen. One theory is that it doesn't really matter whether your player is doing something right or wrong. It depends on whether they're enjoying the game or not. We can probably all think of games that, even when you fail at some games, it's still fun. You know, there are some games that just have that, like, oh, this is great. Now, I can't figure out what's going on, but I still love it. So you can see the players engaged. And there's some games that even if you're doing the right thing and getting rewards, people are just emotionally dead, you know? So watching the player as much as the screen is very important. Now, once you see the emotion, like, well, what is going on the screen to provoke this emotion or lack of emotion? Of course, the screen is useful, too. You know, that checkbox that I told you about, that list of things, you want to make yourself enumerate all the results. And this is where you can really fool yourself. You can say, well, you know, she really didn't figure out how to jump the first time, but I'm not going to count that as a failure because, you know, she got it, and, you know, I just don't think she was paying attention. So you can kind of fool yourself into thinking there isn't a problem. Just be objective. Just make yourself say, look, did she get it right away or not? If not, put a little mark in the box. Now, when you have this, you sometimes get one-offs. There's only one person who couldn't figure something out. And they're very tricky to know to deal with because it really could be a fluke. It could be that you could release the game to a million people and only that one person will be the one that was ever confused by it. So that's possible. So you don't want to overreact because you can make yourself a lot of work. But also you don't want to completely ignore it. You know, hopefully it'll happen more than once, in which case, if it happens twice, even if it seems really bizarre, like, well, we just got two idiots, you know, so that doesn't matter. Well, you know, you've got to face the fact that it's very likely, even statistically likely, I don't know much about the numerology of it, but it probably represents thousands of your potential players. And, you know, like I say at the bottom, you should not indulge in contempt for your player. That's really easy to do. It's so easy when you're the designer, especially say, well, they're just an idiot. I don't want idiots to play my game. My game's for non-idiots, you know? Well, whether you call them an idiot or not, they're representing your audience. And they're things that you might find so intuitive that for all the reasons I stated, you know, are not intuitive to your average person. People who are otherwise smart and people you can respect as a player. Or, you know, you might want to make games for people who are not quite as smart as you, I guess. So you do want to take it seriously if you see something come up twice. Even if it seems ridiculous, try to dig to the bottom of it. Now, when you're looking at it, often you want to focus on what did they actually do wrong and not what did they say, because they're babbling, right? So they'll say, oh, well, I got confused because it was red instead of green. I really expected it to be red. Or, oh, well, I think the button was too small is why I didn't see it. You don't want to necessarily take that at face value. You know, you want to look for patterns that prove what the error is. People aren't always very articulate about what's wrong. This is sort of one of the psychology things. They might seize on a false cause because it causes them less embarrassment. You know, maybe the real error was something that they don't want to admit, so they try to focus on something different, you know, just for an emotional reason. So you want to really, again, be objective about what did they get wrong. Sometimes you can see a pattern. So chances are, if it's really bad, four or five people will all fail. They might all say different reasons, but you'll see in their behavior some common thread to figure out how to undo the problem. Okay, so that's mostly usability testing. We're going to beta pretty soon. again, very early usability testing, though, I think is really essential. It's like building a strong foundation for a house. Who hasn't heard the house analogy with making games? But it really is true. If you have a good foundation and you build on top, you're in much better shape than if you have a bad foundation. Again, if you start with a very small set of functionality and content, you want to nail it down early. Now, what is that small set? Probably one of the things you want to have in your first playable is you ask yourself the question, what do you spend 80% of your time doing as a player? Right, so if you were in the early stage for Mario, you know, from what I remember hearing at another GDC, is the first thing it did was, what do you think? For Mario, what does Mario do a lot of? A lot of running around and jumping, you know? And it seems, well, that's silly. Why do usability tests until we have the monsters and the crates and the switches and all that stuff? No, running around and jumping, you do a lot of that in Mario. And they really worked on it. And that's why they had a lot of content types, even if symbolic, meant that they didn't have art at that stage. They made sort of a sandbox, just different geometric shapes. And the thing was, well, let's try to jump up on that ledge. Let's try to climb the pole. Let's try to jump over this. Let's try to do a long jump. Let's try to do a slide. You know, something that didn't look like very much, but they spent a lot of time just getting it to feel right. And Mario's a good example. If you really pull apart exactly how the controls work, it's actually a very complex control system. It just seems simple. Halo is another example. You know, Halo on the Xbox, it's got a very sophisticated system about how fast you rotate, and when you go over an enemy, it very subtly slows down. Your rotation rate slows down ever so slightly as you get over a target, so slight that the players don't really notice it. It's a very sophisticated system. If you push the stick all the way over hard and fast, it means, well, the guy probably wants to turn around, you know, so your rotation rate is faster if you've moved your stick quickly than if you started off more slowly, and all kinds of things like that. It's a very sophisticated system. Again, in Halo, you spend at least 80% of your time moving around and trying to target things. So you get that early and you nail it early, and you can build that on foundation. And again, keep in mind that for a very GUI-heavy game like an adventure game or something like that, screenshots are a perfectly good way to start getting that very early feedback. So, like I said, you've got the sort of the so-called tissue testers, right, that you don't want to reuse, but also some of them you want to identify as potential follow-ups. So you break the rule of never using them again. You want to go deeper in. You want to invite the same people back. This is difficult to do. You'll find this difficult to get people not to flake out and show up to begin with, and every time you invite another set back, you're going to lose, like, half of them. So you're not necessarily going to get a lot of callbacks. But the good thing is that you kind of chart how their knowledge advances over time. You know, how quickly do they catch on? Okay, now they've got the basics. Now let's say they've played the game for 5 hours, and this is when we would introduce a new concept. How quickly do they now catch on to the new concept in your game based on the foundation they have? Also, as you call them back, you might encourage them to specialize. If you're an RPG, you might say, okay, you are going to do nothing but priest, and you are going to do nothing but warlock, or with RTS, you are going to specialize in one team type and you're going to specialize in another team type, so you can direct people to specialize a bit. So at least you have one data point, which isn't very much statistically, but it's better than nothing. You have one data point for all the different major parts. All right, so that's the usability testing. And again, I really encourage that. It's a hugely daunting experience. It's a painful experience. I think people have gone through it once. You know, they really shy away from doing it again because it's so painful, you know, to see this thing that you thought worked so well and have to face the fact that you're going to have to redo it. You know, you're going to have to redo that dynamic or redo that interface. And sometimes you just want to put yourself in denial and say, it doesn't matter, it's going to succeed anyway. So it's difficult. Just be prepared for that. But it's really rewarding to go back through it. Okay, beta testing is quite different. As you know, this would be your game is basically done, and it's got bugs, but none of the bugs really get in the way of playing, and you're getting masses of feedback. Now, my experience with beta was with a massively multiplayer game. It was easy because you had lots of people online all the time, and they could use the internet effectively, hopefully. So that's good. If you have a solo game, it's a bit trickier, but I think some of these principles still apply. Okay, so I have a few things I'll go through here. All right. First one is make clear to your players what is the vision for your game, which is, of course, a very pretentious term, but the vision is important. How do you summarize what type of game it is? Because if your beta player thinks that it's a different kind of genre, then their feedback is going to be inherently to that. You know, again, using the Halo example, if they say, well, this is really not a very good Halo-like game. This is not supposed to be like Halo. This is supposed to be like a totally new kind of game, or this is supposed to be like a different kind of genre. So you want to make sure very clear, like, we're trying to make the best possible X, Y, Z type of game, so they can at least get in the right mindset. That has to do with the genre. That has to do with how difficult it's supposed to be. Is your game supposed to be very casual and kind of breezy? Is it supposed to be hardcore? Tell people up front, like, this game is supposed to seem really difficult, you know, or the opposite. And also as far as audience, you know, a beta tester might not represent your audience. You want them anyway. You don't want to kick them out. But try to tell them, you know, this is for, you know, teenage girls, you know, and so you're a 40-year-old guy, and maybe you should, you know, make sure to keep that in mind when you're giving us feedback, that sort of thing. You know, you want to make the audience really clear. Multiplayer, a few things I know of more specifically. It's important to clarify if you're making an MMORPG, but just as an example, you want to clarify, well, this is the game that's really all about, should really be easy to solo in this game. For Ashram's Call, there's a lot of feedback that was like, well, you know, I don't think this game does enough to encourage grouping. And you say, well, part of the vision of this game is that it should be viable to solo. And if you do X, Y, and Z activities, it should be a soloable game. So you know, seeing these games, you want to clarify that. Also, how much are you supposed to cooperate with other players versus compete with them, obviously? People might view it through the wrong lens. They say, this game's really way too in-your-face aggro for me. And you say, well, we're trying to make a PvP game. And also, how much should they expect, like, should be fast, constant action versus that kind of sit in town and, you know, make bracelets type of sort of cultural interaction. So, again, it's all about making clear to your beta testers up front, here's the type of game that we want to make, even if it's not their favorite type. And you'll hear a lot of that. You'll have a lot of arguments where they'll try to convince you to make a very different kind of game. You've got to kind of steer them back saying, that's great, we'll do that next. But right now we're making this game, so get the feedback based on that. Second thing is to give them really good tools, tools to report bugs or to give comments. If your game is irritating to test, you know, if it's just constantly a struggle, then all those canary in the coal mine types, the ones that are going to fall over first, well, they're all going to stop testing your game. You're going to be left with a bunch of people that have a lot of patience or have absolutely no life, and they're going to less and less represent your audience. You know, a lot of your audience are the type of people that if they get frustrated, they're going to disappear. So if your game is irritating to test, those people are going to all get squozed out, and you're going to be missing a really important segment. So that's why you want tools. You want to make it very smooth to report things, and you want to reward them for reporting things. One thing that often catches people up that you don't think about in development is if you have save games or a game with a persistent character, oh, we changed versions, okay, character wipe, we all start over again, or save game wipe, you start from the beginning. Again, you're going to burn people out pretty quickly if you don't migrate the save games forward somehow. You know, meaning that, okay, you stopped at level 5, you have the option at level 5 of the first-person shooter, for example. You have the option to go there again. It takes some extra programming, which is the last thing your engineers want to do, I'm sure. It's really boring work, I think. But migrating those forward can be really important. Same thing with characters, if you have advancing characters. The other tool that's really important is making it easy to report problems, obviously, but it's easy to pass this up. You want to think, okay, from the time that I see a problem to the time that I'm actually getting data, if it's more than 10 seconds, I think you're going to start losing people. You want to really make yourself make that as smooth as possible. An in-game form that pops right up. Don't make them tab over and then navigate to a web page and then click a few times before they enter something. You're going to lose things. And also, as you do it, try to auto-populate info from the game. A lot of times the bug is, oh, I was at so-and-so location, this map location, or I am this kind of character. Auto-populate that for them so they don't have to type out, I'm the so-and-so, I had this weapon, and I was in this location. Put that in the form for them. You can always ignore it if it's not relevant to the bug. Another good tool is to let them save and send local logs. It's good for finding just technical bugs, you know, what is their machine configuration for hardware problems. But also, if you are keeping a log of what order in which they did things, you know, what their player actions were, you know, opened inventory, opened up this bag, moved gold from here to there, just keeping a text log, if you can get them to automatically in their bug send just a list of what they've done, that can help you figure out the context. Because they'll probably leave that stuff out. You know, a lot of them, they don't want to type a lot. They want to just report the problem. They might leave out the stuff that led up to it. So tools in beta, also very good. And then you get lots of feedback. With beta, you get lots and lots of feedback. Did I mention the trends? Okay. Because part of it is you get heaps of info, and slogging through it is a trick. But you still want to validate it. You have so many reports that it gets very easy to just think they're always going to keep flowing in. You don't have to reward people for reporting it. But again, you're going to lose the people who aren't really rewarded. You're going to get a less representative audience. So when somebody makes a report, and I'm not saying that we did a very good job of this at all in our beta test. We did a miserable job of it, and I've learned from that. When they make a report, just make sure you at least have an auto reply to their email saying thank you very much. Because if they think, man, I've sent 20 of these reports and I never hear anything back, how do I even know that they're getting them? You know, because they're just one voice among 1,000 maybe. So an auto reply really helps. And then if you can, whenever possible, make yourself use that personal touch. Even if it's 10 o'clock and you want to go to bed, you want to log into the form and say, hey guys, thanks very much, I've gotten some really good bug reports. Or if somebody sends you a really cogent email of some sort, just a few words back say, hey, that was a really good idea. Developer feedback is a huge reward for these people. I mean, the type of people that beta test, they thrive on thinking that, you know, the developer has actually, you know, noticed them. Because they worship developer. A lot of them really worship developers. They admire developers. So a little can go a long way. Part of validating feedback is when you do a new version is detailed build notes to show what improved. When you're a beta tester, sometimes it seems like it's always broken. It's never getting better. Maybe you're focused on one particular thing, like the craft system is still broken, all in caps, you know, in your form. It's still broken, exclamation mark. So if you have at least build notes that they realize, oh, well, here's 5 pages of stuff they did. Yeah, maybe the craft system wasn't on there, but it helps them realize, you know, okay, my turn, my day will come. So that helps. Also, if they reported something and they see in the build notes that it was fixed, that gives them a really good, you know, surge. So those are important. Also, as much as you can, just summarize and report back just what you consider maybe meaningless statistics. Some people really like this sort of thing, like, hey, we got so-and-so many bug reports, good job, because they know that they submitted one of those. Here are the top 10 things that we've heard about. You know, so again, if they contributed, they feel good about that. Or again, if they're picking on one tiny little thing, they realize, oh, okay, I guess those other 10 things are important too, so they'll be more patient. And say in your reports as realistically as possible. You don't want to keep falling down your promises, but say, here's what we're working on next, and we think it'll take about this long. You know, so again, give them a forecast. Give them hope, because being a beta tester can feel like quite a bit of a slog sometimes. Now, you've got tons and tons of feedback. Sometimes a beta test, by the way, can and probably should start with maybe 100 or 200 people. So you have a manageable amount of feedback. You can get plenty of information out of 200 people. So in an early beta stage, I really encourage spend a month, if you can, just with a small group, because then they'll become your core as you expand. But eventually, they'll heaps of people. So you want to always keep your high-level game goals in mind. It can be very confusing when, you know, you're not very confident that your game is fun and there's a lot of bugs and you're really tired out. You can start to lose track of, like, what is this game for? What is the purpose of this game? You get lots of people that seem to hate your game, and they'll go on for pages and pages about how much they hate your game. Maybe they want it to be a different kind of game, though. So you have to say, okay, that person wants a different kind of game. I can try to take their feedback for what it's worth, but we're not making that kind of game. We're making this kind of game, and you got to really stay focused. So, you know, even just having your game goals written down on a piece of paper in front of you can really help. Like, what are we making? You want tools, search tools, log tools, automatic stat adding up type tools to slog through many, many, many reports. The last thing you want to do is have so many reports that you just kind of go catatonic and you stop looking at them at all, right? Because then your beta testers aren't happy because they know they're not being listened to, and you've got this very overwhelmed sense. So you want to plan ahead and just be ready for lots of reports to come in. And you look for trends, and don't go down rat holes, which I'll talk about. You're not going to satisfy, needless to say, because maybe everybody's been on forums, but you can't satisfy every single tester. You can really tie yourself up in knots if there's one person who just seems like they'll never be happy. Sometimes you really do have to just let them be. And also, if you have a forum, you have some people who seem to thrive on getting an emotional reaction from you or getting sort of political power over other people, like their opinion is winning. And it's good to have a community manager who's apart from the development team, who kind of knows, okay, if this person complains about it, it's really worth listening to. If this person complains about it, we'll just take the grain of salt. So you'll see quite a bit in the beta feedback, and just be prepared for that. All right, well, how long do I think have I got my conclusion? Okay, it's not that. Okay, great. I just want to just remind a few top points for usability. I want lots of time for Q&A. So the team testing, you know, you want to make sure that you do it, but it's just not necessarily enough. You want to tune into what your player's really doing. Usability, try to test it early. Make yourself get a first playable in place and test it out as soon as you can. You want to be really scientific and objective in that usability stuff. Again, don't fool yourself. Don't try to fool yourself into thinking, oh, that's just one idiot, you know, or two idiots or three idiots that we happen to pull. You know, make sure that you've actually faced up to some of the problems your game's got. Look for trends, big, massive trend lines rather than little minutiae in beta. And just keep your game vision in mind so you don't stray off when all that volume comes in. So I believe that is it. I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Questions? Can I get the delegates to state your name and the organisation you're from, and then try and put your question in a loud voice. If you're not, if you can't hear the question, please let me know and I'll repeat it for you. So,
Just wondering, Andrew Payne from Pandemic. Just wondering what rewards you gave the usability testers. You pay them, you give them credit in game. Recommend for that.
Right. If they're right here, then just to make sure that the room's on. Yeah, how do you reward those people? At Microsoft, you got free games. There are some, it depends on what country you're in. There are actually weird sort of labor law type things. If you compensate them, it has to be like worth the minimum wage. It's these really weird things. So make sure that if you are going to reward people or not reward people, you kind of know what laws you're dealing with. In Microsoft, it was that you get free games, and that was made people very happy. A lot of people are satisfied just to have participated, because they'll go back and tell their friends, oh, it's a usability test. You know, that was so cool. But free games are good. T-shirts and your company merchandise, often it's really rewarding. A little goes a long way. If you do, I think you have to avoid paying them an actual fee, and often that kind of cheapens the experience. They're real fans of your game, and you give them a wide selection. So if you do get them to pick a game to take home, you want to give them a wide selection as possible.
Yes, back there. Rob Davis, and particularly with the beta testing, we have a tradition, a tendency to attract more hardcore players, but you want a fairly even spread of results. Is there a catch-22 there, and how do you deal with that?
Right, yeah, so in beta, having the distinction between the hardcore and the more casual results. I think part of it is how far you spread your net. A lot of how hardcore your beta players end up being is who did you first advertise to. If you advertise on forums, you automatically get kind of hardcore. The kind of people who spend a lot of time on forums for a particular game are going to be sort of more condensed. So you want to try to use game portals to advertise your beta as much as possible. Things like the File Planet or GameSpy or GameSpot. It's going to get out a little bit wider. Also, seriously, to just go to game stores and try to convince them. Sometimes they're very happy. Game stores are happy to put flyers in a pile on their desk because it gives them credit, you know, to have a local game developer inviting people to do usability or beta testing. So part of it is just making sure you spread the net as wide as possible so you're not starting off with a pool of hardcores. But then the other part is to make sure you're not scaring away the people that are not very hardcore. Again, if the beta test is difficult to do, if it's difficult to report, you're going to lose them. Sometimes you want to stage beta testing. Sometimes you want to start off with deliberately, you say, these first 200 people, they have to be hardcore. We're going to deliberately get just the hardcore people. You get them going for a month or so. You get lots of feedback. You get rid of lots of bugs. And then you do a second and third round of widening your beta test, and that's when you spread out to a larger group. That's good for a couple reasons. One is that that initial hardcore, they feel special. You know, they're sort of an elite, and you can even keep referring to them like they get special forums or something, so they can keep that sense of community. You try not to make them snobby, but a lot of them, they get to know each other and they bond in that month or two. So to give them a separate forum where they can all talk maybe a bit more loosely is important. But then you encourage them to really kind of evangelize and support and say, hey, you guys are our first line of defense. You know, can you guys perhaps go into the forums and answer frequently asked questions, or can you explain things or explain the developer's intentions? So you can imagine the beta has these sort of concentric cores. You start off with that hardcore and don't worry about the casuals. Once your game is fairly stable and you've got a good handle on it, then you go ahead and pump out to those other channels I talked about to get more casual people. And then remember that care and feeding is super important. You want to really ratchet up your sort of care and feeding cycle a lot. Your hardcore won't need it as much because hopefully they're already satisfied. They would have left a while ago. But those casual users, you want to be much more upfront and have the developer praise them quite a lot. And it's just a matter of not losing them. Also, when they report, don't be afraid to ask them to self-identify. You know, do you consider yourself a casual hardcore player? Or how many hours a week do you think you've played the similar game before? Or how many hours a week are you playing our beta? Because you will find some really different changes in how people react. And I think that's where games sometimes go down a rat hole, is they focus so much on the hardcore that they end up losing a large part of their audience, that they make the game harder and more clever and more specialized, and they're very quietly losing the more casuals. Last thing is usability testing is good to do at all stages, and so they're always a good runner to bring you back. that if you go to just get a bunch of naive players for usability testing, it'll remind you of maybe what your beta players are not saying. Beta players are really good for finding like large statistical trends. How fast are people leveling up or going through the game, or how difficult do they find it? Whereas usability is good to really tap into what the casual user can do. It's hard to do a usability testing with a real hardcore player because sometimes you can get a false positive. That's good. That was a good question. Yes?
Joey Buffett from Chrome. I was wondering if there's any extra tips or changes to what you just said for console-only games. You don't have the luxury of using feedback or the solid large.
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. One thing that this is about console feedback, how do you get feedback from your beta players? It's hard in a couple ways. For one thing, many consoles that people don't have, a development kit out there. I know that some console manufacturers, they do have sort of like an internal beta test that's going on. It's one of the most perilous things about doing console games. You probably tend much more to do in-house usability type tests or do something for like an internal beta where it's not as scientific as usability tests, but you just have huge numbers of people come through. You have to kind of run your own beta. So you have something that's obviously not thousands of people because your building would be constantly buzzing, but to do something beyond the usability test. Now, to that, and I guess if it depends on the console, the platform, whether there is a body out there that they will automatically distribute games out, and if they have a development kit, essentially, they can play unsigned games. And now that people are connected, they're probably downloading those games, and they can use the internet. And in-game form, again, would be a great way to get feedback on that, but it's certainly much, much tougher. I believe that also with game magazines, sometimes we'll distribute sort of early versions for you. And if you invite people to a forum, again, you got to realize that more of the hardcore is going to be hitting the forum rather than your casual users. So it's more difficult, but that's the other thing I can think of. But yeah, it's much trickier. So you have to do much more in-house. Another question. Yeah. So I'm kind of like you seem kind of psycho, like you would. That's a good question because sometimes the most valuable beta testers are the most annoying ones that you could possibly come across. And how do you separate sort of the bad from the good? I think that people, often they just want to make sure they're being listened to. I'm not saying to mollify them, not to say, oh yeah, we'll do that, and just kind of hope then edge for the exit. But a lot of times when people are that strident, they've got an issue where they just really want somebody to recognize that they're a very smart and passionate person. And so sometimes you do have to run out the clock with them a little bit. You have to say, okay, I hear that. All right, we'll consider that. You kind of let them get it out. If they start really intimidating people, sometimes you do have to, sometimes in a beta, you really have to pull people aside, recognize that this one person is poisoning, a larger group of people. And you kind of have to be unafraid to cut people loose. Of course, you want to give them a warning. So you might not realize this, but you're kind of scaring everybody. And unless you dial it back a little bit, we're going to have to exclude you from the beta. And I know you don't want that. Hopefully he's not armed. So you do have to be unafraid to cut people loose. And in beta tests that I've been involved in, we have had to cut some people loose. And it's very difficult, but it's inevitable when you have a very large group. Often you'll find that that there's a bit of peer pressure that kicks in. We have a large internet forum. You'll have some people who, sometimes destructively, but hopefully constructively, they'll start trying to hem that person in. That person will get multiple feedback from other people saying, look, you're really kind of ticking us off. And so that can sometimes turn them around. Again, it's often just because they just care so much and they probably got some sort of personality disorder that just makes them too insanely, focused on your game. It's the most important thing to them right now. And so sometimes just making them feel heard and validated and just a one-line email, he'll write like a 10-page email and say, hey, good point, thanks for that. Just to reply back, at least to feel like he's getting it out. So that's my best answer for that. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
The ones that what? Sorry, was the last part? I'm not sure if it would be cultural. Certainly, you do find that you do find different groups of people. Some people are just not very articulate, or it's difficult for them to keep the emotion out of what they're saying. So, again, having a dedicated community manager is often a really good idea because their job is to do nothing but focus on user feedback, get to know everybody's quirks, and get to know how to interpret what people say. Again, if you're the developer and you've been working all day and now it's your job to go through the forum and answer beta feedback, you're probably going to be kind of in a prickly mood. So you can really start a flame war pretty easily if you lash out at people. It's sometimes good to have a buffer in between. I don't see any strong trends. I mean, I've seen things where some really amazing analysis have come from someone who's a young teenager who's able to really summarize things well, and people on the opposite end where they're professional and they should be able to communicate, but you can't get good feedback from them. So it's really surprising. It can be kind of fun to see in beta, to see people who you can tell in their normal social sphere don't have a lot of power and they don't have a lot of people listening to them. And this is their chance, to really make a difference. And that's why it can be really rewarding. You feel like you're giving this person a certain kind of validation they might not be getting. Also, I guess some cultural things, I wouldn't want to generalize, but some people come from a mindset where they just try to be too polite and indirect. They don't want to actually say what's wrong with the game because they're afraid of insulting you, and it's very difficult to make much of their feedback in that case. So sometimes you want to say, hey, we're tough. Go ahead and tell, be constructive, but really tell us what you think. Opening up a private channel is sometimes better. If you detect someone is really kind of meek, you can tell there's a good brain in there somewhere, they've got a good amount of feedback, but they're obviously not going to say it on forum because they're afraid of getting flamed, or they just feel kind of embarrassed. Sometimes it's worthwhile to start up an email dialogue with someone like that. There's another question. Yeah.
When you're working on a game where
are you asking if you work for a game company and how do you beta test for a different company?
How are you beta testing the game that you're working on? Like, say, you have other companies that are going to be making this game versus the game you're making, not necessarily a game that you're making. And yeah, if you want to do it, you just go to testing.
Ah, okay. So you're afraid that you'll learn something by testing their game that you might get accused of bringing back to you?
No, that's not true. Like, you're developing a game from scratch, right?
Yeah.
Then you want to do the early testing as soon as you can.
Yeah. Okay. I think I follow you. Keep going now. Right. That's right. So you're afraid of word leaking out. That beta tester's going to blab to everybody else. Yeah, good. Sorry. Because the other few related things, obviously, that I've tripped across different times, but that is a really important one. And game PR is so critical nowadays that, leaking word of a game out can be really a bad impact on the PR. So often you have people marketing, or maybe your IP holder wants to absolutely make sure that nobody knows that you're making a game for whatever license. So how do you beta test it? Well, one good thing now, I guess, is that now game publicity has tended to get so far ahead of release in a very managed, staged process, and beta testing tends to still be, unfortunately, shorter than it needs to be. Hopefully, there's not generally much overlap. By the time if it was truly beta testing, if you follow the definition of beta testing, you're quite a ways down. Now, usability testing is a stronger consideration, so I'll get back to that. Beta testing, you can't pretend that if you release something to more than just a handful of people, that's not going to leak out. So you really have to accept the fact that your publicity will get blown if you try to have a totally quiet beta test. Maybe you'll luck out and it won't happen. I'm sure it has, but you just can't take that risk when you're talking about PR. So hopefully your time frames are such that the game's already been announced. Sometimes people try, the game's been announced, but we don't want people to say bad things about our game. We don't want to give it bad publicity, and that's also, it's generally not going to happen. I know there were attempts where the company said, you're only allowed to say good things about our game. You can talk about our game in public and only say good things. And obviously people see through that. Now, usability testing, I think, is also a really relevant question to that. So there, it's pretty reliable. You've actually met people, you've brought them in, you've had them sign an NDA, you've given them a game as a reward. Generally, people aren't going to crack. And if they do, it's going to be one person who can be mistaken for a lunatic. They might go ahead and post something out in the ether that won't necessarily keep rolling. So usability, I wouldn't worry too much about. As long as you do due diligence, truth is, you probably know, nobody can really enforce that kind of NDA. Like, I don't think anybody's ever been sued for breaking an NDA. I think it's very difficult to enforce. But you've made a personal connection with them, and people generally want to do the right thing. So I wouldn't be afraid of that. And you're doing your usability testing so early, that is an issue. Yeah, with beta, yeah, don't people blow the NDA, I think. Do you have time for more questions? Yeah.
You mentioned in the
I think there's a point to that. If you didn't hear it, do you lose something by clarifying the vision ahead of time to the beta players? Maybe you want to get their impression. I think certainly for usability, I think it's a very good idea. One thing I didn't mention about usability is, again, people want people to be totally naive to your game. That includes don't even tell them what genre it is, and they'll ask. They'll say, so, is this a shooter? And he said, oh, I can't tell you, right? So you try to get them to form their opinion. So that's very good feedback when you're talking with these blank usability testers. With beta, it might be worth a try. I think that you probably would, you want to do for a short amount of time, and then once all that feedback has come back, then you say, okay, well, now we're going to reveal what the vision of the game is. Hopefully they've come pretty close to it. So it'd probably be good for a short amount of time that you have like a large set of basically naive testers. It's just that, yeah, they'll start influencing each other. A lot of the beta feedback, you find that has these sort of political tides, you know, that once one trend about your vision or about the main problem with the game, once it gets going and there's a few charismatic people speaking to it, you know, it can look like this huge overwhelming thing where everybody believes that. So you wouldn't want to put a whole lot of store by what the massive opinion is. Usability testing would be a very good way to get that. And you do want to ask people at the end, you know, don't be so sterile that you're not afraid to ask people at the end of the usability test, so, you know, what do you think? Did you play this game? You can even do some marketing type stuff at the end. Say, let's say that you've played this game. Obviously, it's further down the road, not screenshots. Let's say you've played this game. You know, would you pay $20? You know, at this point to unlock the rest of the game, that kind of thing. So you can get those. That's a good reminder. Those kind of questions are good for usability. Yeah, might work for beta too for a while. More? Any more questions? Usability, beta testing, how Microsoft did it, how Halo did it, all these other things. Yes, great. Yeah, that's a good question. I didn't even, when I was putting this together, I didn't think of focus testing, which is what that's usually called. So he's mentioning that you get 12 people together and sit around a table to talk about the game. We did do focus testing as part of what's called play test, which I didn't really have time to describe here, but I have time for a little bit. Another thing that's separate from usability test is play test, where you do bring over about a dozen people, about 20 people. They all play the game at the same time, and then you get them into a room to talk afterwards. You can get useful stuff out of there, but it's quite tricky, as you've seen. One of the biggest problems is exactly that. You have one person who just starts steamrolling over everybody. There's a couple of tricks that I remember they would use to do it. For one thing, who your moderator is actually really important. There are sort of psychological skills. People can be trained to be a focus group moderator. Some people make a living out of it. And there is a certain skill to kind of spinning people away from that trend as soon as someone starts to dominate, to deliberately try to pull out the quieter people. And so this sort of sleight of hand that you have to do. So a really well-trained moderator can do that. Yeah, if I did it or if you did it, if we don't know how to do it, it quickly coalesces into that situation. But there are people who are specially trained. Also, 12 is a pretty big group that makes it more likely to happen. I believe they tried to break it up into like 5 or 6 or 7 people as much as possible, which means you might have a raft of 20 people and then you break them into 2 different rooms, each one you're talking at the same time. Because really it's valuable to try to split it. Of course, you need 2 rooms and 2 moderators, but you can get a lot of info out of that. So I didn't talk about playtesting, which is kind of self-explanatory. Again, you start people very naive, have them play right through, but you know they're all going to be talking and forming opinions. Usually it's a good way to figure out how difficult your game is in the early phases. So playtesting is good for that. That's right. They're all separate. So they all come in, you know, we would do like three in a day. It's quite exhausting to, because as a designer, you probably want to be behind the one-way glass and be watching these usability tests, both to kind of get the feel for it as it happens, but also to ask the usability tester, oh, could you ask that person this follow-up question? So usability is serial sequentialized. Because usually the examiner and the equipment, the camera and all that stuff, you know, you only have one or two stations for that. Whereas playtest is deliberately everybody together. And then focus testing is yet different, sort of like a more marketing thing where you put up a lot of concept sketches, say which of these characters do you like the most, or tell me what you would like to see in a next generation RTS, for example. I don't know too much about focus testing. I'm someone who's more into marketing and that kind of development. Maybe another speaker there. Many different ways to get feedback. Well, you know, you got me. I don't know very much about that program. I think that, but there have been cases of sort of paid betas. I think they can be good. The problem is that once people pay for something, their expectations go way up. And that can be a good thing. It could be that you actually want people, you know, to hold you to a very high standard. And it's very expensive to conduct a beta, especially, you know, if you're dealing, it's on console, man. It's a Halo 3 console. Do you know how many people get the program? They have to buy a special kit or something. I think the 360, of course, as you know, that sort of XNA thing they're doing 360, you can basically play unsigned code on your box and go through some sort of modicum of certification and get downloaded and play. 360 can do that, so that would make it possible. But even then, it would be pretty expensive to moderate. I think it's worth a shot, but I'm always one to believe, like, just experiment, keep your eyes open, notice what happens, and conclude whether it succeeded or failed. So I'm glad that somebody's doing it. I'm glad it's not me, because I think that it could go awry and that, you know, people's expectations go way up. Sometimes people say, I paid $2 for this game, and it's buggy. You know, it's hard to give them a sense of perspective, like, dude, it's like only $2, you know? Now, the other thing is you know, people are going to really want to get into the beta so much that you might want to charge people just to cut down the number of people. Otherwise, you have to do a lottery or some other way to screen them out. With Halo 3, that might have been as much reason as any. It might be that they collect the money and send it to Bill Gates Foundation or something. I don't know. Maybe they don't actually need the money, but they just want to somehow filter down people who are more serious. Often you want to have a smaller number of people spending more time. So if they've paid money, it might be a good way to make sure that, look, if they've given you money, they're probably going to actually do more than just, you know, download it once, play it for an hour, and stop. So you might get a better sense of commitment. So I'm really eager to see how that turns out. Cool stuff. We're going to have time. Okay, that's all we got time for.